This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City and KVMR.org. I'm Eric Thome, and I'll be with you till 2 p.m. Today's program concentrates on two local authors who have written very, very different books, but a little bit in common, very, very little bit, beside the fact that they live here in Nevada County. In the second half of the program, I'll be talking with Michelle Shiro about her new mystery called Rainbow Blues, which takes place totally in Nevada County. We've had a number of local mystery writers come on in the last year, and I've got one more coming up in, it was scheduled for a couple of weeks, but that probably won't happen. This is one that takes place almost entirely in Nevada County, and almost everything in it is totally transparently in Nevada County. And we'll be talking with Michelle Shiro about that in the second half of the program. In the first half, I'm going to play an interview with one of my oldest Nevada County friends, a person who moved here just a few years after I did in the mid-1970s. His name is James Norman Huth, but most people know him as Keyman or Keyman Jim. He's had a fascinating life. He left school quite young. He did not graduate from high school, but was always a voracious reader and fascinated with the workings of the world. He traveled around the country from Southern California, where he grew up, and wound up in the Army and toward the end of World War II, then spent it was a total of 20 years in various services, finishing up as a top sergeant in the Air Force. After he left the Air Force, he started a series of key shops in the Sacramento area, and that's where he got his name, Keyman. In the mid-70s, he moved up to Nevada County and opened the Country Store up on Tyler Foote Road, way beyond the North Columbia Schoolhouse, which was a local institution for a number of years. As you'll hear in the interview, some particular events led him to sell that store because he was getting a greater and greater interest in spiritual matters, especially with out-of-body experiences, and later with shamanism. And for a number of years, he taught classes in shamanism to several hundred people over the last few decades in Nevada County. I was one of them. I was fascinated by the discipline. I never know how much literal credence to give the procedures I learned from him, but I know that they produced amazing experiences and amazing ways of looking at the world that I would not have had if I had not undertaken them. A couple of months ago, Jim Huth was diagnosed with very severe prostate cancer, and his prognosis is not very good. He may not be with us for much longer. This goaded him to finish a book he's been working on for, at least 15, maybe 20 years, which is his spiritual autobiography. He calls it Looking Back, My Spiritual Odyssey, and it went on sale at a party in celebration of his life a couple of weeks ago at the Veterans Building in Nevada City. as I say, he'd been working on this for years. I'd helped him with some earlier versions, but couldn't quite give him exactly what he wanted. He went through a whole bunch of editors and finally came up with one who turned out a short but fascinating book. In just a minute, I'll play the interview I conducted with him a couple of days ago. I'll give you a little bit of background when he refers to some of the people. He talks about Monroe and Monroe's Institute. This is Robert Monroe, who wrote Journeys Out of the Body back in the 1960s. I can't remember if Jim read the book before he had his own experiences or vice versa, but it was quite fascinating, and he went to Monroe's Institute back in Virginia, where he spent some time as what he called a guinea pig and had the experience that led him to sell his store. He also worked with Native American vision quests. He did fire walking. He took classes in shamanism from Michael Harner, who's the second person mentioned a lot in the book and in the interview, who wrote The Way of the Shaman and has been conducting workshops in shamanism for a good 25 years. The one that Jim took was at Esalen. I can't imagine a better possible place. And the third person he mentioned is Grandpa, who is Raymond Stone, I believe Paiute healer and shaman, you must say, a spiritual leader, a spiritual guide and healer, who lived, I can't quite remember whether it's Big Pine or Lone Pine, but down in that area. Jim spent a number of visits with Grandpa and then went down and actually spent, I believe it was 7 years living there, almost straight through, and I visited him there a couple of times. So I think those couple of facts will orient you into this conversation I had, and I'm certainly going to miss Jim when he goes. I'm glad he finally got his book going, and I'm really glad I got a chance to talk to him in this way. Jim, I know you've been working on this book for, 15, 20 years, and I've seen sections of it over the years. There was even one point where you gave me a little bit to edit, but I don't think I did it the way you wanted. And now you finally condense it down to about 100 pages.
Well, you did what I wanted, but you were busy when I wanted it done next, so it never did, your life and mine just never connected again. But I liked very much what you did. That was chapter 5 of that first effort I made of 19 chapters when I got snowed in for 3 weeks up on Turtleback Hill. Yeah, no, you did a nice job on that.
Oh, thank you.
I liked that. And thing was, it sounded like you instead of me because you are so much better educated. I had 3 different people work on this because after I had worked on it for all those years, I remember counting one section in there that I was on my 14th rewrite to try and make it say what I wanted it to say. It's amazing. I don't understand how people now can understand when a person talks. I can see why there's room for misunderstanding. But then I had 3 different editors work on that. The last one was Lauren, who, when she finished, it still sounded like me. And so I says, I'm getting kind of old. I think I'll just go ahead and have the thing done. So that's how come it came out. Otherwise, I'd still be playing with it.
And you've said that you have hundreds of pages more written.
Oh, yeah. I just for my kids and grandkids' benefit, I wrote an autobiography, just everything I could remember from the time I was, my first thoughts. That was 400 pages, but that's just first draft.
And in this case, the real story of your life up to the mid-60s, you put in about 4 or 5 pages at the end of the book, because that's not what you were interested in.
Yeah, well, that was just my... This little book here is my spiritual autobiography, which didn't start until I was wherever I was there, 55 or 56 or so years old. And so the first 40 years, just kind of, or 55, whatever it was, just kind of wasn't part of this story.
Although I know that's not completely true. You, as you say, you're not that well educated, but you've been reading all your life voraciously.
Yeah, but English wasn't my main subject.
And I know over the years you've told me fascinating stories about your time in the Army or the Air Force in Japan, in Michigan, in Hawaii, South Seas. Yeah. None of that's in here either.
No, well, that was just my led up to this, I guess, because that was my non-spiritual life. And yet it was the basis that I went through and created so that I could have these experiences and write about them. Because I've always been curious since I was a little kid, curious about what makes this universe work. That's always bugged me. And I suppose down underneath there, I saw something that's always been accumulating knowledge for me, or motivation for my accumulation of knowledge, or the area that I accumulated knowledge. And not knowledge, but experience. Anybody can read the books, but the experience is the thing. Without experience, you don't have anything.
And you list in the book four major experiences.
Yeah.
I can tell you what they are because I just reread it.
Okay.
First one was at Monroe's Institute, out-of-body experiences.
The out-of-body work. Yeah, that's when I sold my store after I went to Monroe's Institute. And as a guinea pig for a week. And wow, not just me, but there was 13 other people there that were guinea pigs for the week's research. He was running 5,000 people through his institute to see what effect the techniques that he had created would have on a general population. Mm-hmm. And I had enough out-of-body experiences there, including the main one that I wrote about in this book here, where I actually came out to my store and saw what the help was doing while I was away. And then I came back and called him on it and freaked him out. But that was a validating experience that caused me to sell my store and start looking into spirituality full-time.
And then the second experience you relate is firewalking.
Yeah, well, you know what that taught me besides overcoming fear? One of the big lessons, just one of them, because it's been a lot, was that I'm not in charge. Humans are not in charge of the life they're leading. There is this, that just made me all the more curious, well, who is and what's going on, until I reached the point where I learned, or where I met. The only thing I can say is myself in the spirit world. I talked about this with Funso, a lama, just a few weeks ago. He came and visited for a friend knew him, and I asked if I could talk to him. And they're very aware of all of these experiences. And so I was able to talk to him for 2-3 hours one afternoon, and we had a big BS session. And I could ask him the questions and get my answers. And he would explain what had happened, which I was never able to have anybody do for me before. So that was a real valuable thing. To meet yourself is, I think, about the ultimate experience. Because the first time you meet yourself, you realize you've known whoever that is forever. That's the person you know the most. And you understand that it's who you truly are, and that is who's operating your body through whatever mechanisms they use, mental. So what I think you are ultimately is conscious thought in absolute darkness. They call it the void sometimes, but you kind of jiggle around in that void area. And you have other experiences besides just being there in the darkness. And you understand you're being part of everything that ever was, and your little tidbit of separation from it, and then you blend back into it, and then you come back out of it. At least that's my experience of it. The yogis had a song like that. It's wave of the sea, descend in the sea. And what you are is like a little wave, a part of everything that is, that can separate and stick your head up out of the ocean, and then you blend right back in with it. And that's the closest thing I can come to describing what that feels like, because you feel that separateness, and then you feel the at-oneness with everything. And that was a big experience. I had that at Michael Horner's, and I had slight touches of it getting ready to go to Monroe's, because they send you 6 tapes, the CDs now, that help you get to that state. Because at Monroe's Institute, that's the platform you take off from to start exploring other realities. Yeah, very, makes a fascinating life, better than money grubbing.
Yeah, although you were pretty good at that.
Yeah, well, that's in my astrological chart, money, sex, and metaphysics. And I look back over my life, and that's what I was busy doing all the time, chasing all 3 of them. And validates astrology a little bit there, too. Then what did I do? Oh, the going out in the, having my vision when I went out in the desert for the first vision quest I had. That was a big one for me, because all of them were big. I've fasted several times, but that one, the first one, told me why I was born this time and what I was to do with the rest of my life. And I was supposed to learn about the spirit worlds and teach what I learned to others. And this has carried me through past a lot of spiritual people who, you're not supposed to tell people that. Well, I said, that's according to you, but you're a human, and I am not here to be guided by humans. I am here following my own path. And you just follow yours, and I'll follow mine. And they couldn't answer that. But I had some people that kind of ticked off at me because of that. But you can't deny when you have those visions. You can't deny the guidance you get from them. It's just, if you don't do it, you don't feel good. Yeah. So that got me partly started. Then I studied with Michael Horner for a month, and that gave me a framework that included most of the experiences that I'd had. But it gave me a framework because I was supposed to teach others, and I didn't even know how. So he's a master teacher, as well as a shaman. And I just kind of roughed in my way of teaching, because what I teach is a little bit different, goal-oriented than his is. And mine is more of a focus on local people. His work includes the whole planet. He teaches 5,000 or 6,000 people a year. Mm. And I haven't probably taught more than 200 or 300 people in 20 years. But I have tried to make shamanic techniques a part of their daily life. And that was what I did, was try and create a normal life, including spirituality. That's what I really got when I lived down there at Grandpa Stone's at Pike.
Before we get to Grandpa, who I think is your 4th main experience, you, when you were working with Michael Horner, as you said, when you had your first real experience of cosmic consciousness, do you want to talk about that at all more, or do you think you've already said it?
Well, at, let's see, about the best part of that was the next morning. I was sitting in a hot tub. They're down at Esalen, and these hot tubs are about 100 feet up on a cliff looking out over the ocean where you can watch the whales go by. And I was sitting in the water about chest deep, about 7:30 in the morning. And it was foggy, up high fog. And if I sat still, my consciousness wanted to get out of my body, and it would just start going up towards that fog. And I knew that if I let it keep going, that my body would sink in that damn hot tub and I'd drown, or it would call me back and I'd have a hard time of it, spitting out the water. So I would sit there and play with it. I would let my consciousness go just as far as it could, and then I would jiggle the water, and where the temperature was changed right at my chest level, I'd feel the heat and the cold, and it'd bring me back to my body. And I sat there and played with that for quite a while. It was real neat. I would just sit there, and my consciousness would just go right up towards the fog, and then I'd jiggle a little bit, and I'd come back, and I'd sit real still again, and away it would go. It was until some people came out and got in the hot tub with me. But, and that also got me over a hang-up I'd had. I left school back during the Depression, or around that area of time, and so I never finished high school. And it always made me feel a little bit insecure because I didn't have an education. But I was afraid it would mess with my ability to be spiritual. And then after having that experience, sitting in that hot tub that morning, I really got that there has been all of these uneducated, so to speak, savages over the millennia who had that same experience that I had and never heard of the word school. So that helped me relax and make it okay to be who I was. That's a little sidebar story about that.
And then going down to work with Grandpa Stone must have reinforced that.
Grandpa Stone was my real apprenticeship. All the rest was going to school. I learned all the techniques. It was the first time I ever went down and into his sweat lodge. I had a real painful stiff neck and shoulder. Been bothering me for 3 weeks. And I didn't tell him about it. I just going to go in a sweat and see if it'd help. He came around to where I was, pushed my head down and held it down with his knee sitting on the floor, and he rubbed right where it hurt 3 times, pushed my head back up, kind of gruff guy, and I couldn't tell where the pain had been. It was gone. And I thought, it'll come back. And it didn't. And so I visited with him for 7 years before I moved down there, and he invited me to move down.
When you first even encountered him was what most people would call a coincidence. Your vehicle broke down.
Yeah. Well, my old truck broke down. I was on my way to Death Valley. I hadn't got there yet, by the way. I have never been to Death Valley, and that's what I was going to do, was go see Death Valley. And my truck broke down, waited for parts, and I had to wait for parts in the campground. And there was a guy there that helped me park because it's kind of a tight fit between some trees with my truck. And he told me there was a sweat going on. And so I thought, well, that'll be something I can do, kill some time for the weekend while I'm waiting for those parts to come in on Monday or Tuesday from L.A. Yep, and that's when I met Grandpa. So after I visited with him for 7 years back and forth, got to know him a little bit. And I went down there one time, and he says, "Hi, what you doing?" I said, "Well, I got to move, and I got to figure out what to do. I've just put off coming." I said, "I just come down here to put off making up my mind." He says, "Move right down here." He says, "I got no one to talk spirit talk with during the week." And we'd talked before about when you have your experiences, it makes it a lonesome business. Carl Jung in his autobiography says, "Lonesomeness is not living by yourself, but having knowledge that you can't share with others." And that is how it is. And so when he invited me down there, it was to help fill in the loneliness, because he and I could talk spirit talk. And we did for the next 3 years till he died. And then I stayed 2 more years while his oldest son, Shorty, took over. Yeah, and that was living it on a daily basis. That was a real apprenticeship, is when you're working at it, not just going to school.
Well, I visited you twice before he died, and I remember the sweats very, very clearly, but then afterwards the meals in the longhouse, where everything was quite simple, very basic food, but I just had the feeling while I was there, these people really know how to live.
That is so true, Eric. I come up here, the first thing I do is I look up the Indians. And you know, when I had the party the other night, it is very emotional that the tribe provided all of that salmon and people to cook it for my going away party. I didn't ask them for that. They just put it out there. And they are the most generous, loving people with the best way of life that I've ever seen. I've traveled around this world quite a bit. 20 years in the military, I spent 13 years out of this country. And there's other fine realities, other countries, but the Indians, for me, Native Americans, is the best way of life I've found. And if I lived longer, I would try out the Buddhists to see if it would speed up my ability for functioning between the spirit world and this reality, because they have an advantage that the Native Americans don't. Native Americans don't write down what they do, so they haven't accumulated knowledge. Each person has their own knowledge. But where they've created all those libraries in Tibet that they're translating now and putting out into the world. But just talking to that one man there, a young man, Funso, was so rewarding. Oh, my goodness. I think he was in his mid-40s, but he'd been a lama since he was a child. And he could answer, and we had a good time because he too has been in the void, and we started talking about similar things and start laughing because we both knew we were talking what the other guy was talking about. And a meaningful life. Now, that's something I learned from him. When I went on that fast, the first one, and was told what I was supposed to do with my life, he says, that is what we call gaining your meaningful life. Before that, your life doesn't really have meaning. And that was the perfect adjective to describe what takes place within you. You find out why you're here, and all of a sudden, everything you do is to accomplish that, and that gives it meaning. And that is so valuable. You know, right now, the psychologist's big potboiler income is treating meaninglessness, because nobody knows who they are, why they're here, or what they're doing. And I can see where that's a pretty sad situation. Talk some more, Eric.
You talk some more, Jim.
Give me a subject. It was, anyhow, you know, all of this fits into shamanism, which is... I had an insight just the other day. Here's a new one, brand spanking new for me this week, fresh off of the press. One of my sons is up here, and he was a gifted child in school. Hell, he's 50 years old now, but he was helping me here. That son of a gun, every time something would come up we're talking about, he'd run over in the computer and look it up if it was something we weren't sure about. Talk about adding to his knowledge. Bingo, bango, bongo. I mean, wow. And then I realized the following Tuesday, I was teaching a class, beginners, and I was teaching them about going in the spirit world to get your spiritual guidance. And I said it. It's just like running to Google on the computer. Mm. And it is. That is how you grow spiritually, is you go over and you ask your spirits what to do about what you got going on. And you pretty soon are leading a life guided by your spiritual nature. So your spirit world is your Google for you.
And you just have to find how to connect to it.
I got the recipe, you know, that's all that I teach. I don't have any answers, I teach you how to go get your own answers, which is Google in the spirit world. And that, of course, and going on a journey, a vision quest, are the two main techniques we use. And that'll keep you busy with a meaningful life. That's what I called my party the other night, celebration of a meaningful life. And that's what I meant by that.
That was Jim Huth, more commonly known as Key Man or Key Man Jim. I talked with him 3 or 4 days ago at his house about his new spiritual autobiography, Looking Back, which is now available around town. Jim was diagnosed with prostate cancer, rather advanced prostate cancer, maybe a month and a half, 2 months ago, and the prognosis does not look good, but one of the interesting things about doing what I'm doing right now is somebody just called in with a report of a friend of hers who had been in a very similar situation and had undergone a special therapy from a doctor in Germany. I know nothing about this, but I'm going to pass it on to Jim, and it'll be up to him what he wants to do with it. Is Booktown on KVMR FM, Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. In the second half of the program, I have with me in the studio Michelle Shiro, who's been active in this area in quite a few different ways. The first way I met her was when she arranged a reading at the Helling Library a year and a half ago or so.
About that.
With the mystery writer husband and wife team of Marcia Muller and Bill Bronzini. And I should have known from that and from the fact that she said she'd read all their books and she was in close contact with them that she'd eventually write a mystery herself. And she has. It's called Rainbow Blues. So I assume you were inspired by Marcia and Bill.
Well, I started this book really in 1996. I had run this nonprofit center that had crisis and support services in the community. And I was getting ready to go off to graduate school, and I had this window of time, and there were so many stories that you could make. You can take bits and pieces of this and that and make a tale. And so I started it then. Of course, after I started graduate school, it went away, you know, went in the back corner for several years.
Now, was that before you moved to Nevada County?
No, I was in Nevada County at that time.
Uh-huh.
It was in the early 90s. And 1994, I went to the Bay Area and went to school at UC Berkeley and worked there for a few years and then came back and started writing again.
Very much like your character.
Well, no. Well, my character at the end moves to Berkeley to get her graduate degree. That's true. And they're stealing here and there.
Yeah, and I guess we'll lead up to the fact that most fiction, no matter how formulaic it may be or how much it is of a particular genre like a mystery that has its own rules usually incorporates something of the author's life. In this case, it incorporates a huge amount because you're Sarah Manone. Will you say Manone or Manone?
Manone.
Is described as the underpaid, overworked director of the Sierra Nevada Women's Center in the beautiful foothills of Northern California, which is pretty close to what you did for a number of years.
Yes, that's what why I started writing it after I had that window of time before I went to graduate school. You know, what I did is I didn't Sarah isn't me, and those other characters aren't anybody specific. They're just the people were inspirations. My experience were inspirations, and maybe it's more less subtle that is so because it's a small community and different people know of me and that background. And
well, yeah. I didn't go around trying to figure out who could this person have been based on, although I know a number of people in that field, but it was quite clear what the physical locations were. Almost all the physical locations.
Yeah, I tried to hide it poorly by calling it Sierra Nevada County and then just using Grass Valley and Nevada City and descriptions of the Root Building and our county library, you know, Madeline Helling Library and restaurants that aren't around anymore, things like that.
The story is told partly in the first person by Sarah and partly in the third person describing, well, for the most part, sympathetic characters, some of the lawyers involved, some of the other financial advisors and social workers and so on. But there's also a chapter where the bad guys get together.
Yes. Yes.
And there's quite a few chapters, and the ones that I thought were actually the most involving and that drew me in the most with the young man who was suspected of the murder and who actually thought that he might have done it himself.
That's correct. Jake, I really was compelled by that character, and that character wasn't inspired by anybody in particular. It was sort of my own creation, and I became very engrossed in that particular section of the book. You know, that tied in. I mean, all of it tied in together, and what I saw is I saw three different characters telling the story. I saw Sarah telling the story, and then I saw the therapist, the lady, lawyer therapist telling part of the story. And then I saw Jake telling quite a bit of the story, and it all intertwined and it all connected in different ways and told a story of some serious corruption in our own Nevada County that involved people on the board of supervisors and in different county departments and in different aspects of the community and even as far as Sacramento. And that was completely made up. But it was fun. You know, I went to the county and I got all the information on environmental regulations in order to build over wetlands and that kind of thing, and then just created the story about this shopping center that got built in the face of obvious problems over and over. There were environmental reports that were,
EIRs?
On top of the ones that the developer had provided, showing that there were some serious problems here. And yet this shopping center got built. And then there was some fallout because of that.
Now, there have been at least two cases similar to that in recent history.
Yeah.
One, the all of the centers in the Brunswick Basin, there was a lot of belief that they were poorly planned and shouldn't have been there. And then the Pine Creek Center, which... many people felt that the environmental impacts were being ignored.
Well, they were certainly those were certainly inspirations for this story. Those were certainly.
But you made it a little worse because I don't think anybody has ever accused anyone on the boards of supervisors at that time or at those times of out and out corruption. They were just very happy to help their friends out.
Right. It was totally made up. It does not reflect on any individual or any board of supervisors that ever sat in those chairs. But it was a mystery. It was a story. It's fiction. It's made up, you know. But you can use real, I guess what I did maybe more obviously than others is because we're a small community and if we know of a we knew that there was wetlands and shopping centers were built over them. In, you know, a lot of us know that. And because it's a small community, you can infer this or think that, or, you know, and but in reality, it's a made-up story.
The Jake, the person who actually is emotionally the most involving, how did you come upon him? His is a pretty unpleasant. He's only 17, but his life has been pretty
a mess.
Yeah, it's a mess. He shows a lot of promise and then a lot of destruction.
Yes.
Do you now? You have worked with at the Women's Self-Help Center that. Self-help center that you ran for a number of years, you probably encountered people like that, and I guess you're working with people like that right now?
Well, I had just finished a grant, it was a time-limited grant, helping create a community awareness program for youth around methamphetamine use. And it was, again, it was another coincidence because Jake was created years ago, and this program, and Jake has a little problem with meth, but he's also an abused child, and he's also a daddy.
Right. We don't want to reveal the end of it,
okay,
but at
no.
the beginning, at the very beginning, the two of the characters are introduced in, well, they're not going to be two characters, but two people who have a great influence on the beginning of the story are introduced setting out on activities that lead to their deaths. And one of them is the young woman, Jamie, whose child Luke has just fathered.
Jake,
and who is about to die in an auto crash. And the other is the lawyer who has some information about the shenanigans, the environmental shenanigans, and he also dies at the very beginning of the book, and those two deaths are what propel everything that happens after that.
That's correct, yes. And he's a civil rights attorney. His background was as a civil rights attorney, but he had developed an interest in environmental law, and so it's kind of an interesting... it's an interesting character, and in some ways, even though he dies early, he's felt throughout the book. You know, would you like me to read a passage or
sure.
something like that? I could read the one about we're talking about corruption and what you know how easy it is to fall into that if you don't have a sense internal sense of values and right and wrong. So anyway, this is the supervisor, and he's just left the courthouse to head to Sacramento, and it's just a very short piece. After Jimmy Powell left the courthouse, he got in his brand new Ford Bronco and headed down Highway 49 to Sacramento. He was in a good mood. He put on a local country music station and tapped his fingers to the wheel of the music. He felt on top of the world. His bank account was fat, his chances of re-election looked good, and last but not least, it looked like he had just locked in the final piece of a real estate deal that could net him enough for a nice, comfortable, early retirement. Powell honked impatiently as he passed a small white Civic. The traffic and the slow drivers really got up his ire. He was mostly oblivious to the role he had played in the overcrowding of Highway 49. This two-lane highway was the major artery to Interstate 80, which led to Sacramento and points west as far as San Francisco. This was the road increasing numbers of Gold Country residents spent two or more hours daily driving back and forth to work. Powell's effective pro-development good old boy politics didn't take too much into account. The changes that had occurred during his tenure had burned at Nevada County infrastructure with its massive new shopping centers on old thoroughfares and new housing developments for families who often had to commute out of the area to afford their homes. He had become adept at turning both his and the public eye away from the landfill infrastructure and development problems and toward the blinking dollar signs. I'm going to stop there. Then it goes into the actual story, but this gives you kind of an idea of this character in this story.
It not only gives you an idea of the character, but it also lets you know that the author has strong political and social beliefs.
Yes, which is another is very important, you know, I think to me. I think that what I really like, I think that the genre of fiction, mysteries, and the women writers who are writing mysteries, and it seems women more than men, take on social justice and environmental and rights and wrongs and really look at the morality of the situation. You know, you read, and Sarah Paratsky, for example, she's amazing, and she's won every award there is to win. And she just wrote a memoir called Writing in an Age of Silence. And she was really affected by 9/11, but not so much by 9/11, but by the passage of the Patriot Act and how that affected all of us, and what happened in Guantanamo and all of that. And that informs her writing. Our activism, you know, as writers and as women, to address injustice, to address poor and people who are disenfranchised, those kinds of issues, they come over and over in a mystery. It's usually people who are disenfranchised that are somehow connected into a mystery, that choose, you know, a life of crime or become a victim or something like that. But what I like about the genre is that you can tell stories within it and have them be socially relevant as what your point of view is. And I think Sarah Paratsky does that exceedingly well. And she has a hard-boiled detective. They made a motion picture out of her. But she tells very compelling stories. You know, in one book, she's on the board of the Battered Women's Shelter. Another book, she's marching for abortion rights. You know, there are a lot of different kinds of things. She has one where there's a right-wing radio DJ who does some pretty awful things, you know, says some pretty awful things on the air, and he becomes the bad guy. In the course of the book, he's one of the bad guys. So, you know, it's kind of a fun way to inform and express a point of view that is very important.
Do you think that led to your choice of the characters who'd be involved, and in particular, Jake?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about, I've just hinted at his past life, but why don't you tell us sort of where he is when the book begins?
Oh, well, where he is when the book begins is a sad, sad situation. He has been kicked out of his home because he got his girlfriend pregnant, and he was on the fast track to college, and he had skipped a year of school, and he had, I think, an afternoon job, and so he goes to live with John's family. John is the attorney that dies early on. And he starts this self, and when John's family insists that he deal with the beating and the situation with his parents, he decides to go, and he's not going to live there anymore. And so he goes to his friend's house and then starts getting involved in methamphetamine and starts getting involved in not being able to keep up with school and starts this web of lies in his life and starts deteriorating. And this book is a story of how he goes in and comes out of that. And it's a long, long journey. And it takes him to a lot of new places and self-examination and learning what kind of life he really wants to have. And, you know, taking accountability for himself. So.
Speaking of accountability.
Yeah, we're out of time, huh?
No. We have a good 5 minutes left.
Oh, okay.
But one topic that we've been talking about most heatedly, we could talk about Jake a whole lot more, but I realize that in the amount of time we do have left, this is a book published by a company I will not mention, but I was a little struck when I read it at a number of glaring typographical errors, and apparently this is something that you hold the publisher accountable for?
I do. I'm furious about it. I mean, I do. I'm furious about it. because my understanding is that they would go through and do what a copy editor would do. And they didn't. And not only that, they put something in it that said, this is verbatim by the author, word by word. And that isn't what our agreement was. And that was just, I was blindsided. And, you know, I'm grateful. I have a publisher who published it. I didn't have to put out any costs. You know, it's distributed and all of that. But this is a publisher that will that has, you don't need an agent to go through this publisher. And I am I've learned a really hard lesson. The first time I looked at it and I was reading it out loud and I saw something, I went, my breath just went out of my body, and there's just nothing I can do about it. I am just, I have no control over it. And, you know, Sarah Paretsky in her book talks about the publishing industry and how it's consolidated and how there's fewer options for writers, and the market of, you know, quick sells and fast turnover, and how the shortened time on a shelf and all of these kinds of issues. And that creates publishers that fill a real need, but that aren't as... I don't know if you want to say scrupulous. I don't want to go there, but as quality driven as others, and that was heartbreaking for me. But anyway,
so that leads just to the obvious question: are you going to write another book? If you do, is it going to be another mystery? And if you do, are you going to publish it the same way? Or
yes, no.
Okay.
No, I'm not going to publish it with the same author.
Oh, I didn't mean the same.
But I would like, you know, to go more traditional route, to be honest. Yeah. I won't go into the long story of, but I wanted to get a publishing credit out there, and I had worked very hard on this book, and I assumed this publisher would do what they had promised to do, so...
So what are you working on now?
I'm working on two books. I'm working on one that gets started at Harbin Hot Springs, and it's kind of interesting, a mystery with the same characters playing a role and just continuing on with their life. And then I have another book that I just started that goes back, it's almost a memoir of something very dramatic that happened in my childhood, and that is a real good basis for a book, and I'm just exploring that right now.
And if you do proceed with these, you'll go out and get an agent for them, or will you?
I would hope so.
You won't try to approach publishers on your own. I guess that's nearly impossible these days.
Well, obviously I did it. It is hard. That's what I'm saying. This book about that Sarah Paretsky wrote, she goes at length about the publishing industry and how difficult it is now for authors to find agents and go through publishers. That there's just, it's the market of high returns. What's going to sell the fastest? It doesn't matter if it has merit, but what's going to grab the largest audience? And a lot of that is the Grishams and the Clancys and, you know, the big names, and they're just automatic sells. So there's fewer and fewer efforts being made to reach new authors, to mentor new authors.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I've been talking for the last 20 minutes or so with Michelle Shiro about her mystery, Rainbow Blues, which has been published by a company we will not mention, but is available in local bookstores and probably online as well.
Yes, at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. Possibly Borders, I'm not sure.
Okay, and that's Michelle with a single E, and Shiro, S-C-H-I-R-O. The book is Rainbow Blues. I've gotten at least one call after playing the interview with Jim, Keyman Jim Huth, in the first half of the program. He is still alive. He's not in the best of health. As I said, I am going to pass on the information that I just received to him and see what he might choose to do with it. In the meantime, his book is called Looking Back, My Spiritual Odyssey, and it's published by Carl Mautz Publishing from Nevada City, and is also available at the regular local outlets. Before we go, there's one upcoming event I'd like to mention. Thursday is Twelfth Night, which is also Epiphany, and there's going to be a reading called Personal Epiphanies, Poetry of the Season. The main readers are Ed Buren and Maxima Khan. It'll be hosted by Q. Lauren Rue Smith, and it'll be followed by an open mic on the subject of personal epiphanies. It's going to take place at the Broad Street Bistro and Gallery, 426 Broad Street in Nevada City, this Thursday, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. So this has been Booktown. I'm going to be out of here in just an instant or two to make way for Jimmy Carty's Rock and Roll Party. Before I go, I'd like to let you know that there will be no Booktown for the next two regularly scheduled times. The 19th of January is Martin Luther King Day, and I certainly want to make this comes on just about when the Bethel AME choir would be singing, and I'd rather listen to them than to me. And then on the 2nd of February is going to be a membership drive. So this program will be back on the 19th of February. In between, I may post on the Booktown blog a couple of entries about books I would have, whose authors I would have interviewed if I'd had the time. But as I said, Jimmy Carty's on his way, so I'm getting out of here.